time to check in on some of the week's top news in national politics. The trial of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort continued this week. The president is commenting on a 2016 meeting between members of his campaign and a Russian lawyer. And election results are in, some of them, in races around the country for Congress, races for governor, and more. Our question for you this week, with the midterm elections now just a few months away, do you predict a Democratic wave, or will Republicans maintain the control they have now at the federal level and in most states? If you're a Republican voter, what do you think the party should focus on? Are you worried? How should President Trump figure into campaigns? If you lean toward the Democrats, how left should the party go to energize voters? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Reed Wilson is The Hill's national correspondent and the author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this Manafort trial. President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, on trial this week for charges of tax evasion and bank fraud. Big moments, the testimony of Rick Gates, Manafort's former associate, another member of the Trump campaign at one point. What kind of stuff are we hearing at this trial, Reed?
So we're not hearing a lot about President Trump himself, but we are hearing about the legendary exploits of Paul Manafort. This is a guy who's been around American politics and Republican circles for about 30 years now, and he has gotten involved as well in campaigns overseas, which is not terribly uncommon in and of itself. What is uncommon is that prosecutors allege he squirreled away tens of millions of dollars, didn't report that income to the IRS, and didn't report that he was working for foreign governments and foreign interests while lobbying here in the United States. So we've heard testimony from a number of bookkeepers and accountants and experts at the Treasury Department and things like that about why or what happened and how he possibly broke the law. And we also heard this week, as you say, from Rick Gates, who is not just an associate, but was almost a mentee of Paul Manafort's for a very long time, worked for him for years. And then when Manafort went to become President Trump's campaign chairman, Gates went and worked on the campaign as well, ended up becoming the executive director of the transition, which is, no small feat. I mean, that's a big deal as the administration was staffing up. This is after Paul Manafort was fired from his job as the campaign chairman. Gates testified that Manafort had directed him in a bunch of illegal activity, and that he had he himself had engaged in illegal activity, including skimming some money from Manafort through sort of padding his expense reports to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. This has been a pretty dramatic trial, and one that is, if Paul Manafort is found guilty, he's likely to go away to prison for quite a significant period of time. This, though, is about the larger effort of getting Manafort to flip and to share whatever information he knows with Robert Mueller's prosecutors about President Trump and what President Trump knew and when.
Yeah, the president has tweeted about what he characterized as unfair treatment of Paul Manafort, saying Al Capone hadn't been treated as badly as Manafort is. Some people read that as a signal that, hey, if it comes down to it, the president would be willing to pardon Manafort. That's speculation from some political observers at this point. But as you say, in the trial itself, there's not a whole lot about the Trump campaign. A little bit of mention, but that's not the focus in this particular trial.
Yeah, and that tells me that there is more to come about President Trump's campaign, at least. I don't, we can't say that there's anything to come about the president himself, but it's clear that Robert Mueller's investigation has these tentacles that are going out in a lot of different directions. This is just the first and most public one we know. He has, a dozen or more prosecutors who are working on other elements of this investigation. So, for all of what the president and the White House say they want this thing wrapped up quickly, I don't think this is going to wrap up particularly quickly. We may have a few more, Friday news dumps on this before this whole thing wraps up.
Another thread in this whole thing is this now famous 2016 meeting at Trump Tower between campaign officials, including the president's son, and this Russian lawyer offering apparently damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Now, the president tweeted over the last week, this got a lot of attention. Here's the tweet. This was a meeting to get information on an opponent, totally legal and done all the time in politics, and it went nowhere. I did not know about it, quoting from President Trump's tweet on that. A lot of people took that as an admission that this was seeking information from the Russians about the Clinton campaign, which had previously been denied as a motivation for this particular meeting.
Yeah, and for whether or not you like President Trump at all, it's clear that he has not told the truth about this meeting, because we've got about 17 different explanations about what this meeting was about. First of all, we heard it was all about adoptions from Russia and the Magnitsky Act. And second of all, then we heard that that President Trump may have known about it later. And then the president dictated a misleading statement while on Air Force One, by the way, coming back from Europe, about Don Jr., his son's involvement in this meeting. So the shifting sands of explanations on all this really raised questions, in my mind at least, about sort of how far do we go? You know, why should we believe that he didn't know about this meeting when he has changed his tune on so many other things about this? Of course, this meeting is central to Mueller's investigation into whether or not the campaign colluded with Russia. We'll see whether or not he's able to come to any legal conclusions about that. But the fact is, there are shifting explanations, and the president has not told the truth on that. That is demonstrable from his own statements, not from, you know, anonymous sources or anything like that. It is simply a fact that he has said many different things about this one particular meeting, and now he's adopted this line that collusion is not a crime, which is remarkable because he's spent months saying there is no collusion, there was no collusion. Look, he's right about the fact that campaigns look into what their opponents have done, both domestically and overseas. But the fact is, it's, you know, the president has now basically admitted that his campaign folks, including Paul Manafort, who was in that meeting, including Jared Kushner, who was in that meeting, including Don Jr., who was in that meeting, at least engaged with Russian officials trying to find information about his opponent. That's something that he's denied for more than a year.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, about some of the top stories in national politics. Reed, let's turn to yesterday's elections. The story's not completely done. Who knows, something might break as we're talking on this. People have been watching these special congressional elections, and we have one last one. I believe it's the last one in Ohio's 12th district. It's been a heavily Republican district, a long time since a Democrat has won that. What happened there? Why are we paying such close attention?
So this is a district that was left vacant when the incumbent member decided to quit and take another job with a business group back home. It is a district that is in basically the Columbus suburbs and exurbs, sort of north of Columbus, Ohio, and a little bit to the east. It's a district that went for President Trump by 11 points back in 2016, and the Republican candidate this time around, a guy named Troy Balderson, appears to have won by about 1,700 votes. Out of around about 200,000 cast, 1,700 votes in an election that big, that's not a lot, and especially in a district that President Trump won by 11 points. If we apply that same sort of margin, you know, a Democrat outperforming Hillary Clinton by that much, there are 40 or 45 seats around the country that are less Republican than this particular district. National Republicans threw the House at trying to win this seat. They spent millions of dollars. They sent hundreds of volunteers into the field. They don't have the amount of money they need to defend all 45 of those seats to that same degree come November's midterm election. So this hints at Democratic enthusiasm to actually show up to vote, and it gives a sense that Republicans face a really difficult landscape here. They avoided what could have been an absolute catastrophe by losing this seat if in fact, Balderson holds on as they count the final few hundred ballots here. In talking to a lot of my Republican friends today, they're taking a message about this. They realize that Republicans are they need to be motivated to show up to vote. They're not feeling that motivation right now, and that could put a lot of seats at risk come November. Remember, Democrats only have to win back 24 House seats to win back the majority in Congress. There are 25 seats that voted for Hillary Clinton back in 2016 that elected a Republican congressman at the same time. Those are the prime targets, but there are a lot more seats that are far less Republican than this seat, open seat in Columbus was, which tells me that the landscape this year is pretty broad.
We're looking at the top national political stories of the week with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. We're going to talk some more about election results and what lies ahead in November. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, hopes, and fears for Election Day in November. Are you seeing a blue wave on the way, a red wall, a purple swamp? I made that one up today. What's going to make the difference? If you lean toward one party or the other, what do you want to see your candidates, your party, talking about? If you're a Republican, how does the party make the case? Should President Trump be heavily involved or stay well clear? Democrats, should your party go to the more progressive wing, reach for the center? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, checking in on some of the top national stories in politics. You can join in on your election questions, hopes, predictions, 800-642-1234. Staying with elections, Reed, a primary in the race for governor in Kansas, the president weighed in on the last at the last minute in some ways. What happened?
The president, this is remarkable. So we just put up a story about this a few minutes ago. President Trump has been much more aggressive about weighing in on contested primaries than any other president in my memory. I mean, George W. Bush didn't do this. Barack Obama didn't do this. But President Trump has no problem throwing around his endorsement and trying to remake the Republican Party in his own image. In this case, he endorsed against the sitting governor of Kansas. That is way outside the sort of political norms. This is a guy named Jeff Collier, who was elevated to the governorship when Trump picked his predecessor, Sam Brownback, for an ambassadorship. Collier's been in office for, 8-9 months now, and President Trump endorsed his opponent, Kris Kobach, the firebrand Secretary of State, a very conservative guy both on immigration issues and on voting rights issues, for the governorship. The polls closed last night, and I thought this was going to be a blowout, that Kobach was going to walk away with it, given President Trump's power within the Republican Party, but he didn't. And Kobach is leading now by about 191 votes out of 250,000 or more cast, which is, you know, a very tiny margin. That's even closer than that Ohio race we were talking about. There are still thousands of provisional ballots and absentee ballots to count, so it could in fact flip, and we could see, but the bottom line is we see a very tight race here between an arch conservative and somebody who is much more sort of traditional Republican, despite President Trump weighing in. And I think that shows sort of the extent of his power. He's able to fire up the conservative base, but, you know, there are some Republicans who are much more comfortable with sort of that traditional type that Governor Collier represents.
Bring on a caller. We invited your calls on the elections this year at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Thanks for having me on. I understand that the party that's on the outs during an off-year election usually has a benefits, but it wasn't the problem for the Democrats in 2016 is that they had a candidate and the titular head of their party under federal investigation, and now we hear in 2018 with a titular head, well, the head of the Republican Party, President Trump, under federal investigation, and that this is hurting the good economic news for him, and it is undermining his party's chances. The issue of a wave aside, it'll be interesting in your commentator's response. Thank you,
Jim. Thanks for the call. Will the ongoing investigations of President Trump and his campaign and the overall Russia probe be something that hurts Republicans this year?
Yeah, it certainly could be, Jim. And if Robert Mueller decides to drop some kind of bombshell before the campaign, before the midterm elections actually happen, yeah, that could swing a lot of votes. However, I think there's a broader picture here that's sort of already baked in. Republicans absolutely love President Trump. Democrats absolutely loathe President Trump. And those in the middle are probably more on the Democratic side than on the Republican side at the moment, given where his approval rating is. If I had told you that, 2 years ago, that in the midterm elections, the stock market would be up, 5,000 points since the last presidential election, unemployment rate would be plumbing, new depths, all-time lows. In Wisconsin, it's actually the lowest rate that it's been since the Bureau of Labor Statistics started keeping track back in 1976. If I told you that, you know, GDP was growing at north of 4% on an annualized basis, you would say, boy, the incumbent party, the party that just did all that, is going to have a really great year. Well, the fact is they're not going to have a really great year, and that's largely, I think, because President Trump's approval rating is simply so lousy. He is such a polarizing figure. Again, Republicans absolutely love him, but Democrats and those in the middle don't. His approval rating is somewhere between 40 and 45%. Historically speaking, that's better than George W. Bush's was back in 2006, which was a big Democratic year, but it's not as good as President Obama's was in 2010, which was a good year for Republicans. So that tells me that the sort of the conversation about President Trump is largely already baked into where we stand today. The big things that could change are, yes, the Mueller investigation, but how many people does that actually convince to vote for President Republicans or for Democrats? I'm not really sure. I don't think it's a huge number. The other thing that could change is that economic number. If we start to see numbers going down, maybe because of Trump's trade war or because of just sort of the natural cycle of the economy, high gas prices that we're seeing this summer, something like that, that could scare voters even more. Those voters who sort of like what the president's doing on the economy, if the economy goes south, boy, that base is going to fall away real quick.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at the latest news in national politics. Reed, we've been talking about races for Congress. You wrote a piece on how all this translates into races for state legislatures. And now Republicans have run the table in a couple of midterm elections. They control a huge number of chambers and state legislatures around the country, including both of them here in Wisconsin. You talk to people from both parties. What are they looking at?
And I talked to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss of Wisconsin, who, you know, openly acknowledged, just like a lot of other Republicans do, that there is a level of Democratic enthusiasm that they can't ignore, that they have to pay attention to. Republicans control 68 of the 99 state legislative chambers across the country. That's pretty near an all-time high, as best I can tell, in sort of the modern era. And they have basically won so much in recent years, and they've got such a huge advantage over Democrats, that there's going to be a natural ebb. They're going to give back some of those gains simply because they won in territory that they probably had no business winning in the first place. But because of President Trump's approval rating, they could give back a lot more. State legislators are sort of the least able to control for the national environment. They've got less money than somebody running for Congress or a U.S. Senate seat, and they are far less known. You know, how many listeners can actually say who their state representative is? Now, there have been times in my life when I wasn't entirely sure, even though I cover this stuff. But when we think about those state legislators across the country, you know, we could, because of President Trump's approval rating, if a national wave does in fact build, we could be talking about Republicans losing 500, 600, maybe 700 seats. President Obama, in his first midterm, lost 708 seats in state legislatures. That came right at the time before legislatures started redrawing district lines, and that's the reason this thing really matters. We're going into another redistricting cycle. If Democrats can balance out the playing field, win back a lot of the seats that they lost, then they'll have a much stronger hand when it comes to redrawing both legislative and congressional district lines after the census in 2020.
Strategy-wise, are people in either party talking about, hey, we're going to try to localize this thing, or we're going to mention President Trump for good or ill?
Yeah, we hear a lot of legislators talking about the local issues that they want to talk about and their plans for the future. Robin Voss told me, I thought this was a good line, he said about two-thirds of your campaign should be about the future, one-third of your campaign should be about the past. So talk about what you've done a little bit and then talk about what you're going to do a lot. So we're going to hear a lot about localized issues. You know, in Wisconsin, you're going to hear about that low unemployment rate. You're going to hear about Foxconn coming to Wisconsin. You're going to hear about cutting taxes and what Governor Walker's administration has been able to do. On the other hand, in talking to, you know, primary voters around the country, I've been struck by how much people are thinking about President Trump, even when they're voting for things like governor's races. I mean, how many governors end up being a direct, you know, challenge to the president of the United States? The answer is not many, but people are thinking about Trump, and that means that Democrats are going to be able to talk about Trump when they want to as a cudgel against Republicans in the same way that Republicans talk about Obama or used to talk or still talk about Nancy Pelosi when they're talking about Democratic candidates, sort of lumping them all together. And Republicans are going to have to figure out a way to say, look, I support the president when he's right and I oppose him when he's wrong, and not, you know, turn off their own base while doing so. So it's a tough balancing act. When the shoe was on the other foot, when Republicans had the advantage in 2010, they stormed to a big win by talking a lot about President Obama and specifically the Affordable Care Act. We'll see if Democrats can convert the same sort of energy into gains on their side.
I want to touch on a policy issue. The Trump administration this week is calling for changes now to fuel economy requirements in the auto industry, the whole country, overriding California exemptions. What changes?
So the Obama administration wanted to roughly double the miles per gallon standards that cars and light trucks and things like that have to adhere to by 2025, ratcheting up the mile per gallon standard to about 36 miles per gallon. The Trump administration wants to freeze that hike at the 2021 level, which would be at about 30 miles per gallon. So still higher than it is today, but not as high as possible. The Trump administration says they want to do this because basically, as manufacturers build lighter cars, those cars can be more prone to accidents and deaths on the highways. A lot of experts don't actually think that that is, in fact, the case. Under the Clean Air Act, California has the authority to set its own pollution rates, and the administration wants to end that. But that's going to be pretty difficult to do. That would likely take an act of Congress. And California, of course, plans to fight as strong as possible to keep their own ability to regulate the commercial market. But basically, there are so many other states that follow what California does that we could end up with a country with pretty much two fuel standards, one half that would be at that 30 mile per gallon rate, and the other half, led by California and basically blue states that follow it, would have a much higher standard. So, you know, car manufacturers are actually rallying against this proposed change. They want one standard nationwide, even if it means they've got to make more fuel-efficient cars. They still, it's better for them to have that sort of one standard.
We'll leave it there. Reed, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, in our weekly roundup of national politics.